You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume Number 4 by Rudolf Steiner, the book, The Philosophy of Freedom, translated by Michael Wilson. This is a revised Michael Wilson translation for the 150th anniversary of Steiner's birth. This is Chapter 14, entitled Individuality and Genus. The view that man is destined to become a complete self-contained, free individuality seems to be contested by the fact that he makes his appearance as a member of a naturally given totality, parenthesis, race, people, nation, family, male or female sex, close parenthesis, and also works within a totality, parenthesis, state, church, and so on, close parenthesis. He bears the general characteristics of the group to which he belongs, and he gives to his actions a content that is determined by the position he occupies, among many others. This being so, is individuality possible at all? Can we regard man as a totality in himself, seeing that he grows out of one totality and integrates himself into another? Each member of a totality is determined, as regards its characteristics and functions, by the whole totality. A racial group is a totality, and all the people belonging to it bear the characteristic features that are inherent in the nature of the group. How the single member is constituted and how he will behave are determined by the character of the racial group. Therefore, the physiognomy and conduct of the individual have something generic about them. If we ask why some particular thing about a man is like this or like that, we are referred back from the individual to the genus. The genus explains why something in the individual appears in the form we observe. Man, however, makes himself free from what is generic. For the generic features of the human race, when rightly understood, do not restrict man's freedom, and should not artificially be made to do so. A human being develops qualities and activities of his own, and the basis for these we can seek only in the person himself. What is generic in him serves only as a medium in which to express his own individual being. He uses as a foundation the characteristics that nature has given him, and to these he gives a form appropriate to his own being. If we seek in the generic laws the reasons for an expression of his being, we seek in vain. We are concerned with something purely individual that can be explained only in terms of itself. If a person has achieved this emancipation from all that is generic, and we are nevertheless determined to explain everything about him in generic terms, then we have no sense for what is individual. It is impossible to understand a human being completely if one takes the concept of genus as the basis of one's judgment. The tendency to judge according to the genus is at its most stubborn where we are concerned with differences of sex. Almost invariably, man sees in woman and woman in man too much of the general character of the other sex and too little of what is individual. In practical life, this does less harm to men than to women. The social position of women is for the most part such an unworthy one, because in so many respects it is determined, not as it should be, by the particular characteristics of the individual woman, but by the general picture one has of woman's natural tasks and needs. A man's activity in life is governed by his individual capacities and inclinations, whereas a woman's is supposed to be determined solely by the mere fact that she is a woman. She is supposed to be a slave to what is generic, to womanhood in general. As long as men continue to debate whether a woman is suited to this or that profession, quote, according to her natural disposition, close quote, the so-called woman's question cannot advance beyond its most elementary stage. What a woman, within her natural inclinations, wants to become had better be left to the woman herself to decide. If it is true that women are suited only to that profession which is theirs at present, then they will hardly have it in them to attain any other. But they must be allowed to decide for themselves what is in accordance with their nature. To all who fear an upheaval of our social structure through accepting women as individuals and not as females, we must reply that a social structure in which the status of one half of humanity is unworthy of a human being is itself in great need of improvement. Anyone who judges people according to generic characteristics gets only as far as the frontier where people begin to be beings whose activity is based on free self-determination. Whatever lies short of this frontier may naturally become matter for academic study. The characteristics of race, people, nation, and sex are the subject matter of special branches of study. Only people who wish to live as nothing more than examples of the genus could possibly conform to a general picture such as arises from academic study of this kind. But none of these branches of study are able to advance as far as the unique content of the single individual. Determining the individual according to the laws of his genus ceases where the sphere of freedom in thinking and acting begins. The conceptual content which man has to connect with the percept by an act of thinking in order to have the full reality, pages 73 to 84, cannot be fixed once and for all and bequeathed ready-made to mankind. The individual must get his concepts through his own intuition. How the individual has to think cannot possibly be deduced from any kind of generic concept. It depends simply and solely on the individual. Just as little is it possible to determine from the general characteristics of man what concrete aims the individual may choose to set himself. If we would understand the single individual, we must find our way into his own particular being, and not stop short at those characteristics that are typical. In this sense, every single human being is a separate problem, and every kind of study that deals with abstract thoughts and generic concepts is but a preparation for the knowledge we get when a human individuality tells us his way of viewing the world, and on the other hand, for the knowledge we get from the content of his acts of will. Whenever we feel that we are dealing with that element in a person which is free from stereotyped thinking and instinctive willing, then if we would understand him in his essence, we must cease to call to our aid any concepts at all of our own making. The act of knowing consists in combining the concept with the percept by means of thinking. With all other objects, The observer must get his concepts through his intuition. But if we are to understand a free individuality, we must take over into our own spirit those concepts by which he determines himself, in their pure form, without mixing our own conceptual content with them. Those who immediately mix their own concepts into every judgment about another person can never arrive at the understanding of an individuality. Just as the free individuality emancipates himself from the characteristics of the genus, so must the act of knowing emancipate itself from the way in which we understand what is generic. Only to the extent that a person has emancipated himself in this way from all that is generic does he count as a free spirit within a human community. No human being is all genus. None is all individuality. But every person gradually emancipates a greater or lesser sphere of his being, both from the generic characteristics of animal life and from domination by the degrees of human authorities. As regards that part of his nature, where a man is not able to achieve this freedom for himself, he constitutes a part of the whole organism of nature and spirit. In this respect, he lives by copying others or by obeying their commands. But only that part of his conduct that springs from his intuitions can have ethical value in the true sense. And those moral instincts that he possesses through the inheritance of social instincts acquire ethical value through being taken up into his intuitions. It is from individual ethical intuitions and their acceptance by human communities that all moral activity of mankind originates. In other words, the moral life of mankind is the sum total of the products of the moral imagination of free human individuals. This is the conclusion reached by monism. The end of chapter 14.